start streaming live event. You piece of shit. We can cuss on this. We can cuss on this, dude.
Oh, good.
You know that? We've got an explicit tag on iTunes. Nice. Fuck you.
Please stand by.
It should come up in just a second. There's so much network demand on this right now, but there we go. All
right, we're live.
Yeah, we are officially live. All right, I'm going to spam this link everywhere.
Did you just...
Hopefully the integrity of the stream is good. Wait, I guess I don't have to reiterate that, do I?
Sure.
All right, that's good enough. Okay. Maybe Twitter is not an efficient use of bandwidth. Alrighty then. So, unfortunately, this is going to become echo hell for about 2 seconds.
All right. We're in my world now.
First, this must... Ah, thank you. And... Oh, man, I haven't finished my coffee. Oh, yes.
Put it in there. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to unmute this, which means we're going to be echoing. And, alright, I am starting the TeamSpeak recording now, except that has to change first.
User in your channel started recording.
Alright, so starting the hard recording right now. Sync 1. Alright, we should be good now, which means that I don't have to talk into this thing anymore, really. Okay, so those of us joining us in the stream, if there are any in the stream, hello. You can join us recording this live episode of Drycast by visiting drywall.ws/teamspeak. I should put that in the fucking description. And be part of the Drycast. Be part of the most famous podcast for millennials, by millennials, on the net. Yeah, alright, this is obviously not Fook. Look at me, I already did that, I'm proactive as shit. Okay, so, I think we are about ready to begin the official recording, even though we're solo. That's okay. Alright. What? I feel much more weary than I should. So, this is marked with an X.
Because you opened it on.
Yeah, but that's... I didn't mark that. So, I guess I'm probably drinking someone else's drink from the past, but whatever. Oh dear. Okay. Using new software, you know, we're on the edge. We're on the edge, that is for sure. Sorry, I gotta chug this.
Chug away, my friend.
Gamer Dad Boy Uggs.
Oh, I managed to squeeze that one in there. Yeah. Good job. Good on you, mate.
Well, I think it's important. I think it's as important or more important than model railroading.
The standard of uncool.
Oh my god. You know, I looked at a thing today that was like how to prepare your voice for a big time recording.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing was do not consume caffeine before you this.
As you're sitting here chugging on a rather large mug of coffee.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Well, man, that's gonna come in. That's loud as shit, but whatever. All right.
You ready for this? You ready?
I am.
All right.
I am ready.
We still haven't done any introductions or nothing.
I'm going to introduce
the
podcast.
You gonna do that? Are we gonna do that?
I'm getting in the right mentality.
Ah.
Looking at the text, Dapper Will Wheaton. Alright. So I cannot move this after we've committed. It cannot be moved. Ah! Okay. Alright. Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of Drycast. Today is December 7th, 2014, 73 years after the big thing that happened at the place... In the Pacific Ocean, we call it Pearl Harbor Day. I am your host, David Blue. With me today is special guest, author, dark lord of internet culture, millennial superstar, Terry Cox.
Hello all, I'm Terry Cox, and let the Cox jokes commence.
Yep, this is the rest of the show. The future of the show is...
Jokes about my last name.
Just Cox jokes. That's
plethora
it.
Of Cox jokes.
Yeah, just go away if you don't want those. So, I guess, just introduce yourself, why not?
Sure, even though your string of titles,
yeah,
you know, accurately depicts me, I won't disagree with any of them. I'm just a casual gamer, casual author, and, full-time Dark Lord of the Internet.
Yeah.
Which, I honestly have no idea what that means, but that's what I do. I don't know, just a coworker. Decided I wanted to.
Yeah, Terry is technically my boss. So that's a good fact.
Yeah, I'm the assistant manager without the title or the pay, but with all the responsibility, and it's pretty great.
Yep. Yeah, I was thinking about that. It's just, if we had Mike, if I was doing this with Mike, can you imagine?
That would go awful.
He wouldn't step in here. Huh. By the way, we're coming to you live from Studio Eat. Those of you watching the live stream, hello, welcome, good morning. Those of you listening to this in the future, fuck you, hello, welcome. Good morning. Yep. So, this is the magic of editing is that I get to say a lot.
Good job, Chico.
All right, well, you've described yourself. I'm going to describe yourself, or you now. I'm not going to describe yourself. I'm going to describe you. This took a lot of thought. Dapper Will Wheaton.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I can live with that. It's not necessarily what I'd call a compliment, considering all he's done but not done, but I'll take it.
Yeah.
I will say I'm...
not done.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But I will say I am prettier than him.
Yeah.
That's just, without a doubt, I am prettier than
him. I mean, I can't be too much of a judge.
I mean, you can't attest to it.
Yeah.
Just take my word for it. I'm prettier than him.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it's just Will Wheaton, but, you know, doesn't make you suicidal immediately.
Yeah, I'm all right with that.
Yeah, yeah. So, two millennials on the podcast that decides what is and what is not cool. Well, I can say that we're both not cool.
That's debatable. Absolutely
no.
Debatable.
Nah.
I'm the cooliest.
But we have to go by the standard.
By the standard society?
No. Okay. I developed this, so... The standard, 22-year-old, attractive, art student at NYU, IQ over 135, and hobbies include, like, oh, man. Okay, that's too in-depth. Let's step back. So, yeah, but I decided, basically just, like, you know, the cool ones, the cool kids, you know, mid, or early 20s, the early 20s NYU art student thinks is cool. That's the standard of cool. And what isn't cool, what lies in the opposite end of the spectrum, is model railroading.
Which we can both admit to have done at one point or another. Granted, I did it when I was a child, but...
I mean, I did it when I was a child, too. When's the last time I...
Whipped out your training?
It was at least a year ago. It was at least a year ago, so...
You were a child a year ago.
I mean, no, but... it's been a while. All right, it's been... I moved on, maybe, probably not, actually.
Bigger, greater things, like flying kites.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, probably uncool.
No.
Damn, that was fun.
Flying kites now, you'd simply be, you know, people would just be, what is that? I haven't seen a kite fly in anything but film in, well, a very long time.
I can agree with that. Yeah, no, I cannot remember the last time I saw a kite other than me flying it.
Yeah, yeah.
Go fly a kite, people. People tell you to go fly a kite, it's not because it's a bad thing. It's actually kind of fun.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's...
And I'm not talking about the single line little piece of crap kite you get at Walmart. I mean, like a dual line trick kite. That shit is fun.
Yeah, I mean, as a child, I just remember, I think I only had, like, you know, a few successful kite flights. But when you have a kite and you're at the end of the string and it's, like, way up there and you can't see anything, and yet it's, like, pulling you with tremendous force, when you're a child, that is terrifying. It's like, like, what the fuck is up there that is keeping me, that is keeping this thing aloft, you know? But,
I can attest to it being probably the most terrifying thing I've ever experienced, but also the most fun thing. Being a 90-pound child, you know, and, my grandpa pulling out the parachute kite.
Oh,
yeah. That thing dragged me across the field.
Yeah, that's...
That was the second most terrifying moment of my life. The first being the one time I went deep-sea fishing and almost getting pulled over the boat by a fish.
You went deep-sea... Okay, where did you go deep-sea fishing?
Well, it's hard to say deep-sea. It's deep lake fishing up in Lake Michigan.
Okay.
And it was a big old rainbow trout. We actually managed to reel it in, but only because my huge-ass stepfather grabbed my 90-pound self and held me in the boat.
Yeah. I had a similar story, actually. Wasn't deep-sea fishing. It was fishing in a pond. And I was like 5, and I had like one of those my first fishing poles, and I hooked a turtle, and I was just like, this just must be a big fish, it just pulled me in. But
so you actually got pulled into the
water. Yeah, but it was a pond, and I was on the shore, so it was just basically just slowly walking into the water. I mean, it wasn't really scary. It was just sort of, it was a battle of brute force, and I lost.
With your my first fishing.
Yeah.
Did you lose the my first fishing pole, or did you cut the line?
I don't think so. I don't remember. I mean, I've only been told the story. I don't actually remember.
Ah.
It's one of those things where people are like, you remember when you designed the Saturn V rocket?
Yeah, no, I actually 7? Do remember doing that.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, it gets warped over time. Do you remember when you were a sea creature? Little Jimmy came from the deep, and we through genetic therapy, we made him into a human boy, and we adopted him as our own. Man, see, this list, this the show notes actually meant something to me, like, 2 hours ago, but now I am too fucking out of it.
Some of this is, I don't even remember reading. But, oh yeah, creative decisions, as made by Google.
Yeah, concept. So, you go to a director. I know this because I'm making Children of the Corn 30, and I'm the director, and I'm the person that everyone comes to when they have questions. I can't solely claim that title because I'm also making it with my friend Brent, who I guess we're more or less equally creatively invested in this film. And so we end up going to each other a lot. But, you know, and it's not like I'm a Hollywood actor. There's probably like 20 people that have asked me questions about the movie, so... But anyway, so the job of a director is you're just basically the guy that everyone comes to ask questions. And what else do we do, or what else do we go to when we have a question? We go to search engines. So imagine Google, or some other search engine, gains the ability to make creative decisions and makes them whether you want it to or not.
The idea behind it is completely astounding, and it actually shakes the foundation of AI, and then you start to touch on actual AI, and that's...
Well, and it's, I think, because of the massive intricacy of Google, because, I mean, traditional AI is very limited, but Google's just by its nature, not creative to develop intelligence, but the nature of its... The speed that data travels is faster than anywhere else on Earth. The amount of knowledge is vast. You know, it's basically... What's that... Oh, what's the big... The bad thing in that one movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger, I think.
Are you talking about... It's... From Terminator movies?
I don't know.
Skynet?
Yeah, that thing.
There you go.
Yeah. I mean, how... Oh, guys, first time Google has ever been compared to Skynet, right here.
Right here, everybody. big stuff going down here.
Yeah, so, but I think that, you know, yeah, I think, and what would you have after, you know, you develop the capability, you develop the interface to go up to Google and be like, how do you want this shot put? And then Google's like, here you go.
This is how you're doing it.
And that movie would literally be directed by Google. How would that be to see in the credits? You know,
you might actually see some more originality, just because it'll pull off from all the information it has what has been done already.
Well, that's the age-old question of AI preference. You know, when an AI starts to have preference, then, which, you know, does Google have preference? Yes, it's towards the most ad revenue for so. So, the first intelligent artificial being is David Blue, basically. basically me.
David Blue, the soulless ad bot.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, if you're just tuning into the live stream, this is Drycast Episode 3, and I'd like to remind everyone that you can join us. We don't have anyone in the TeamSpeak right now, and I'm devoting massive amounts of resources to it. That's a lie. But you can join us and be on this podcast and meet the famous author, Terry Cox, the millennial superstar. Like, you're like the... Will Wheaton is the captain of the millennials. You're the first officer.
Right. Yeah. Thanks. Appreciate it. I will never take an order from that man.
The first officer of blogging. Oh, dear.
I don't even blog, David.
Yeah. I
We've already established it's not in our repertoire to blog.
I started a blog. All right. It's a car blog. And my entire goal was to, you know, just get into new media. You know, to just kind of get writing out there. My prospective goal, or my prospective career as an auto journalist. I wrote one post, that was the introductory post, and I've been working on the second one for like 6 weeks. So obviously I'm not successful, because it just doesn't work with my style of writing is to revise 400,000 times, which we're going to come to later when we talk about writing books, being
an author,
being millennials.
Being millennials.
we're millennials.
Okay.
I looked at the definition.
Look at, what is the definition of a millennial?
All right,
we're going to be doing this.
Google.
We might as Oracle. It's the Oracle. We're referring to Google as Oracle now.
If only we could get to the original Ask Jeeves.
Dear God, is that still around?
No, it just redirects you to ask.com.
Oh, gotcha. In other news, gamer dad boy Uggs.
A person reaching young adulthood around the year 2000. That's not the same definition that I saw.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was reaching the age of 10 at 2000. So, or is it near the year, or around the year? Okay, so...
No, it's the definition I saw is, like, anyone born between, like, I think it was late 80s And like 2000. Those are millennials.
So like late. So we'll say, just to put a line on, hard line on there, we'll say 87 to 2003.
That's a little bit wider, I think. But yeah, that's probably
too wide. Too wide. We can narrow it down. We can make that
the smaller. Numbers podcast.
The numbers podcast. We can make
1-8. This is a, you just go search iTunes, look for Drycast, and we are basically just a numbers station that you can access at any time.
We'll just spout out some random
10. So yeah, but
okay.
We define millennials, so we're done with that.
Define a millennial. Okay, so according to our new definition of millennial, I am a millennial, and I guess I am a millennial superstar.
Yeah.
According to my title string, which I feel like needs some work.
Yeah, okay, that was offhand for one thing.
No, but totally. No, you did really good for being you only had like two of that string prepared. So
yeah.
I mean, pretty good.
Yeah,
some stuff in there.
I try. Okay, since generations are a cultural term, I think a more apt definition of millennial would be like anybody that has been told in their youth that they have like greater computer skills than they actually have for doing a simple task.
Good God, that's so many people though.
Yeah, but okay, it's nobody, but it's the psychology of oh man, I heard a really, I've been listening to NPR too much, but they called so kids now, like being like, I'm probably like early on the verge of this, but they call them tech natives. So the tech natives are kids that literally grow up with technology all their lives. My first computer, I was 7.
I was
and
8.
Yeah. So I don't know if we're probably just on the edge of that. What an interesting place to be born. I'm so glad. But
yeah, we toe the line. We definitely toe the line.
Yeah, and then it said that, you know, and that adults are tech, what's the word? Colonials, tech immigrants. There we go. So the kids are the tech natives and the adults are the tech immigrants. And that's actually kind of an insightful term, or insightful terminology there. But I'm not going to elaborate into why, because that's kind of boring.
On Drycast.
Yeah, on Drycast. Yeah, I mean, I don't. All right, let's mention something. I mean,
something. Mentioned, nailed it.
Something.
Speaking of tech, because
yeah. No, I was actually thinking of that as you were talking. So we've been talking about Google and technology. Interesting piece of news surfaces today that California actually has 80,000 tech jobs per capita now, which is significantly higher than everywhere else in the world. I mean, you know, we know that California is the tech hub, but 80,000 per capita is certainly impressive. But yeah, so
I'm leaning towards completely made up, but
yeah, that made up statistics. Edward Snowden today revealed that the NSA actually has an entire city of 20,000 people that just sit and go through every single status post of every person on Earth on Facebook, and they just read it, you know, because every bit of your data is sacred. Every bit. Even the stuff that no one will ever have an incentive to go and find. So, leave you with that tech bite. I need to come up with segments, but I need to rename the segment. Alright guys, we're coming up to 87.
Just numbers.
Yeah, just numbers.
Just not in any kind of specific order. Just David randomness.
We're coming up to our weekly segment, Gender Hell.
Story of my life.
Okay.
Well, it'd be really helpful if someone listening to the live stream or
what's going on with Twitter right now? Can't even look at my phone.
I mean, we've got stuff to talk about. I just don't want to burn it all without any other actual input besides our own.
Yeah. Well, I'll talk to that. Talk to that later. All right. Let's see. Oh my. Yeah, you know, Twitter is a whole different place. That could spawn a plethora of topics. All right. Well, while we're on the subject of news, so I'm sure you've heard about Sony Pictures getting hacked, and everybody suspects it's North Korea because Sony Pictures produced the interview in which Seth Rogen and some other guy that is exactly like Seth Rogen in almost every single way and is also famous and has probably been on Saturday Night Live, but I don't know his name. They are funny guys. They're funny. They're basically themselves. Actually, I think they might actually play themselves.
I think they do actually play
That's
themselves.
That's really, yeah. They're just, of course, it's an exaggerated version of themselves because this is in the entertainment world. And they're paid, or not paid, they're instructed by the Central Intelligence Agency, they're invited to go to North Korea to have an audience with the North Korean big guy, the Un guy, I can be disrespectful toward, you know, the North Koreans. And they are instructed to assassinate him by the CIA. But, so North Korea has denied hacking Sony Pictures and has instead responded by making, announcing a state-funded film in which they kill Seth Rogen.
They being Korea.
They being North Korea. North Korea specifically.
Korea. I should be specific.
Yeah.
They being North Korea.
The South Koreans just make really good cars. But they might all, I mean, for this one.
They might be all in for it.
To kill Seth Rogen, I mean, you know, and all Seths. The world could just be rid of Seths. Yeah.
That's the plot of the movie.
Yeah, basically, just North Korea just,
eliminates Seth. It's a Seth-icide.
Seth-icide. Seth-icide. that's the title of the movie we got right there.
Nailed it. You're welcome, North Korea. If you use it, we won't partial the funds. I mean, it's only fair.
You know, if North Korea, in my position as an extremely amateur film director, if North Korea came to me and they said, we want you to direct our film, I would want to say yes. But because I'd like to survive, I would say no.
As it turns out, even though David often comes to work not alive,
yeah,
he does enjoy breathing.
Yeah, well, I mean, North Korea would be, see, like, I think a lot of journalists, you know, really are itching to get in there because they want to die. That's like, if you're going to become a journalist, you're going to go to journalism school, be serious about it, and be competitive, and shoot to be an Anderson Cooper 2.0, you have to essentially have a death wish, like an insatiable appetite for hard news, right? So those kind of people are the ones itching to get in North Korea. I am not that kind of person. If I was, I'd be much more successful. I probably wouldn't be here right now. I'd probably be, if I wanted to record a podcast, I could probably do it at the Reynolds Journalism Institute at MU. But in a studio, with studio people, with bald guys looking in.
However, we're
in Studio E, which is, it is a fire hazard.
It's a total fire hazard.
But I still like saying live from Studio E, it's Drycast.
Also known as Try Not to Diecast.
Mm-hmm. That one is a keeper right there.
I like that, Jim. That's a good one.
All right. Well, we've gone over the news. This is laid out just like a real podcast.
If by real podcast he means kind of jumping all over the place, but yeah, totally nailing it.
Well, the news usually it's okay. The podcast format, you go discussing podcast format on a podcast is really meta, but we're millennials. That's what we do. So, usual podcast format. Introductions, silly shit. Usually the silly shit goes really way too long because everyone that makes podcasts are nerds. Podcasting isn't cool, by the way. But anyway, it goes way too long. And then they do like the news segment and then they discuss the news. And then, you know, that's just kind of a... But I listen to a lot of gaming podcasts. So that's in general, when you have a podcast that follows a specific game.
Yeah, I listen to a total of 2 podcasts.
Like, regularly? Like, you listen to every...
Just 2 regularly, yeah.
Are they weekly podcasts?
Mm-hmm. Well, one kind of... I think it's bi-weekly. One of them's bi-weekly. The other one's weekly. But, no, that's the extent of my podcast knowledge, and now that you've said it out loud, it totally is. They have the silly shit, the news, and then they get into the meat of what they're trying to get across during their podcast. Except in the one that just tells a story. That one's just amazing.
Yeah, that's a good idea. There's... I don't know, the podcast format in that, you know, you can search it on iTunes. In that sense, that sort of stuff is podcasting, but it really isn't what I think of as podcasting. Because podcasting is basically just, like, you have a low-rent radio show that's so low-rent that you can't even use the same title. Like, if I went on the community radio station with this show, and I was like, hey guys, it's Drycast. You know, that they would just be like, what the fuck is that? I mean, even, it doesn't really make sense, you know, even if into being in the medium of a podcast, but still, I'd have to change it to, like, Eat. My show would be just called Eat, and it would be so misleading because a bunch of foodies would tune in. They'd be like, well, you know, where's the food? And I would just play, like, you know, noise. Where's the food?
As we decided, if we run out of shit to talk about, that mic is going so far down David's throat while he's making a noise.
Oh, man.
That is going to be insane.
No, I can't do that. It's too valuable.
Too valuable?
Yeah.
Well, we are curious as to if that is covered under warranty. Did you look that up?
No. I didn't have time to do that.
Oh, that's fair.
We could just lie and say...
It totally is.
We could give an answer. It is.
It totally is. I just looked it up on my phone that's in my pocket. Nailed it. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it, David. It's so much fun playing.
Did you look it up? No. Well, we could lie. It is. well, I was kind of expecting more people to show up because a bunch of people said they were going to show up.
Yeah,
fuck them.
But what a bunch of people say and what a bunch of people actually do are two completely different things.
Well, I mean, you know, being a 20-something and being like, hey, dude, you want to, come be on my podcast later? It's kind of like...
No, no, no. Word it exactly how you worded it to me.
I don't remember.
You don't remember that? Let me just try and refresh your memory. Terry, you should be on my podcast. I reply with, why? Do you remember your response?
Because you're interesting?
No. That's not what you said.
Because you'd make it interesting?
No, because you said, you might make it actually good.
Ah.
that was your exact words. And then John proceeds to lose his mind.
Yeah, well, that's always a good pitch. I'm amazing at pitching things, you can tell.
I'll be honest, I was reluctant. I was extremely reluctant. I don't know. He invites me to come hang out in his closet.
Yeah.
This could end poorly. But, you know, whatever. As we started talking about what we might talk about tonight, I got a lot more into it. It seems, I think that this could be definitely a weekly, maybe bi-weekly thing. That I'd be down for just sitting in your basement, closet, shooting the shit. I'm all right with that. It's fun. It's entertaining.
If I wasn't so freaking exhausted from days, like, upon days of sleep deprivation, I'd probably be a little bit more fun.
But... Yeah, I'm trying to carry this damn podcast for you, dude.
Oh, shit.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, shit.
Just strapping and carrying. Jesus.
Oh, man.
And I'm not the best person to rely on for that kind of stuff.
Well, they say that there's an optimal creative environment. I feel like this isn't it.
No.
I feel like it's not.
I'm sitting in a folding chair in front of a door.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly in my most comfortable creative mindset.
Yeah, it's difficult to be creative in a closet. It really is. But we are creatives. We're millennials.
millennials.
We're pulling this through, all right?
I'm a millennial superstar. We're going to get through this.
Yep. I mean, Will Wheaton, leader of the millennials. Not just of nerds.
How is he a millennial? I feel like, how old is he?
He's a millennial. Okay, yes, he was, okay, I know he was like, what, he was 20 in the 90s, like the early 90s?
He's really that old?
Yeah.
Oh my god, I was leaning towards low 30s tops.
Not low 30s, I think he's mid 30s now.
If he was born...
His wife looks older than him, which is really weird.
If he was born in the 80s, he's probably getting up to 40.
Well, technically, okay, so mathematically he's not a millennial. But he's fucking Will Wheaton, okay, so...
He is a child.
Will Wheaton is, I mean, he blogs, he hangs out with Felicia Day. Felicia Day, the queen of the millennials.
The leader and the queen.
I mean, you know, just look at them. Watch Tabletop. You know, they really are. They're the leaders. They're Barack Obama is nothing compared to Will Wheaton and Felicia Day. They are the cultural leaders, and that's what really matters, so...
Oh, man.
Yeah, actually, Tabletop's not cool yet. It will be someday.
One day, when we're older.
Well, that's a good segment into you explaining tabletop gaming.
Oh, dear God. I was...
Because I have a lot of friends that have played tabletop games, and my problem is that I'm not interested in anything. That's actually a pretty good statement. Like, I don't pick up on new things very well, and I know I have, after 20 years of trying... Nearly 21 years of trying to participate in card games, in board games, and probably a tabletop game, that it is not optimal for me. Because, well, actually, pretty much any social video game, if there's, like, other people in the room, I'm just gonna intentionally, like, fuck things over. Like, this is a really long introduction to this, but, so, my friend and I, when we were kids, he invited me over to his house, we had, like, a sleepover thing, and he had this game, it was NBA, probably like, you know, 2003 or something, 2002, basketball. And there's a button for an intentional foul, which is apparently a thing. I didn't know it was a thing in basketball, where you just, like, intentionally get a foul. It's only used rarely when you, like, need to get a timeout or go whatever, you know. I don't remember the rules of basketball. I played basketball in middle school, but I don't remember it at all. But, so, an intentional foul, like, it literally is, you just touch somebody. So you're just, you know... Everybody's getting ready for this big thing, and then you're just like, boop, and the ref's like, fuck, like, everybody stop. So, guess what I did for, like, after I discovered that button, that's all I did. I ruined that game for him. I just kept intentionally fouling until every game was over. Just
I think that makes you a terrible person.
Yeah, that's... But anyway, so...
Leading into tabletop gaming, you know, I honestly don't know where to exactly begin with tabletop gaming. It's just the best way for me to describe the game, the particular tabletop game that I play, is take chess, ditch the chessboard, or if you want a better description, make the chessboard 4 feet by 4 feet, add some hills and terrain features on there that actually do apply to the game, and then give your pieces a shit ton more movement capability, stats, attack ability, things like that. Make it infinitely more complicated, and then try and, you know, take the opponent's king. That's the best, simplest explanation for tabletop gaming. A more in-depth explanation is that it's like when you played toy soldiers when you were a child. If you did that,
I didn't have friends.
Neither did I. It's so bad.
And now we're in a closet.
Now we're in a closet. I had no friends. It's so bad. But okay, so there's always the only example that I have is like movies that I see like kids and they're always playing like the boys are always playing with the toy soldiers and in the mud and. They're just basically making pew-pew noises. Sometimes the tabletop game I play degrades into making pew-pew noises at each
other.
That's
amazing.
It's the best thing ever. Like, you're rolling dice saying pew-pew.
It would start off that like that with me.
It's just... I mean, you can't pew-pew if you're not shooting, and you can't really shoot someone in your first turn, unless...
I would scream.
Start screaming.
Ah!
But... I think it's a lot more, in my mind at least, tactical and than chess will ever be for me.
Tactical chess. That's what tabletop gaming is.
Tactical chess. It's more tactical, it's more, I don't know, in-depth than chess will ever be for me. Chess, I played as a child, it got boring very quickly because every piece had this specific move that this was all it could do. Whereas in War Machine, you have a piece and it has a set move value of 6 inches. You can move whatever direction you want, any direction you want, however you want, as long as you total up to 6 inches or less. And it's just that one aspect alone just widens the whole horizon of what you can do on a board. And yeah. It astounds me, like, that someone sat down and was, like, writing up all these rules. Like, I have the book. It's solid, inch and a half thick of rules.
Yeah.
And it's amazing, and I love it. And there's people that sit down, and they have it memorized. They have not only the rules memorized, but they have the stats of each one of their individual pieces memorized. And there's different stats all across the board. No matter what faction you play, there's just all over the place stats. I mean, there's going to be some similarities, like if you're playing the particular faction I play, low defense, easy to hit, high armor, hard to damage. Almost everything kind of has that aspect about it, but there's a lot of different stuff that you've got to try and keep in mind when you're trying to take down your opponent. And it's just, sometimes the task gets a little mind-numbing, because when you have one specific plan, and that one specific plan goes straight to shit, which would, in my case...
Yeah.
It often does because I have terrible, terrible luck when it comes to rolling dice, and that's another aspect it adds that chess doesn't have. Chess doesn't have randomization. In War Machine, you have dice. The dice decide whether your plan succeeds or fails.
Yeah.
And your job is to try and mitigate that chance of loss as best you can, which there's different aspects and ways for you to do that through, I don't know, casting a spell that enables you to roll a third dice and discard the lowest. It adds so many more avenues for victory than checkmate.
It's punk chess.
It's punk chess.
Because it's I mean, from what I understand it, coming from less experience than anyone else on Earth, professional chess players, like, it's all like a matter of equations, and you're just sitting there, like, mapping out probabilities in your mind, and then, you know, there's no chaos, really. I mean, there is, but with the element of randomization where there's no predictability whatsoever... it's punk chess. Tactical punk chess. That's...
I like it. I'm gonna call it tactical punk chess from now on.
Tactical punk chess. TV yeah, scene. I mean, I get, like, I understand the appeal in that big rule book, whether it be physical or, metaphorical, which is, I guess, probably why I play MMOs, because it's, like, the, you know, something to tackle, it's something to engage your mind, but the great thing about MMOs is that I don't have to paint anything.
Okay, that's fine.
I don't have to go anywhere.
It's true, you don't have to go anywhere. I will give you that. I will hand you that on a silver fracking platter. But you don't have to drive across town to play your game.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm very uncomfortable around people, so that would be...
You also don't have to haul, like... upwards of 20 pounds of models and figures.
Just to log in, yeah.
Just to log in.
But, I mean, there's, of course, everyone, this is a classic argument. Classic, and by classic, I mean it's been, like, in the last few years of MMO gaming, that MMOs sort of take the rules that tabletop gaming has and role-playing games and, like, pen and paper role-playing games, you know, and they remove the social aspect from it, you know, because...
That's debatable.
Yeah.
It's just...
I don't know. The problem with that is people argue that games are a social thing.
They can be, and it's very easy for them to be. Like, I don't know, I mean, you make your way into a guild that's actually social and active. I mean, that's,
yeah, oh, definitely, no.
That's absolutely...
That's happened to me once.
So. Same here. When I played Final Fantasy XIV, I had, up until that point, every MMO I've ever played, I just kind of ran solo because I didn't like people. People were annoying, and they just bothered me, and I got tired of getting yelled at for doing one thing wrong. And then I had joined Final Fantasy XIV when it first released. Oh, I said that wrong. When it released the second time.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. I got so into the game, and I got actually kind of somewhat good at it, and I felt more comfortable around people, and I ended up joining a guild, and they had a team speak, and despite every part of my body telling me, don't do that, don't go into that, you don't want to meet these people, you don't want to add, you know, personality to the people you're playing with, and I did it, and I ended up falling in love with a lot of people. They're just really good personalities, and except for one Sarah Apple, ruined everything for me. He was annoying. Here's the David Blue of Final Fantasy XIV.
Oh, no.
But there's not a whole lot of social aspect to War Machine.
Yeah.
I mean, you have you and the opponent, and your only real interaction is... it ranges between bickering about a role, bickering about the measurements you've made, because everything is about the measurements, whether it's the range of your weapon or...
I can imagine.
It gets really hairy. Like, if you're playing against someone who knows you, they're kind of just casual about it, and you're not finicky with your models, you know, kind of shifting them around, then you're not going to run into problems. But I've seen, with my eye place, people being total douche nozzles about measurements and wanting to remeasure what the other person just measured every single time they measure something.
You're like a ref.
Yeah, and, well, that same person almost got banned from the tournament by the ref, which is a press ganger. They kind of run the whole thing, but he's on the ban, like, he's almost banned. He's that bad of a... Like, he's not a bad player. He's actually pretty talented. He's just a bad player, but not a bad player. I can't think of the right word here.
Bad player is in he doesn't have the right mentality for the event.
Yeah, he's not a good sport.
Skills, but antisocial.
Yeah, he's just not a good sport. I guess I really can say he's just not a good sport, and he's very brutal about when, like, he's a bad winner, and he's a sore loser.
Yeah,
and I think that those kind of people just need to stay away from the those kind of games. I understand that you maybe enjoy it, but you are literally making it that much more likely for the other person to just not want to play anymore.
Yeah. Now, see, this is why I think open carry should be legal. So when you go to one of these games and you get guys and they're both carrying, like, ridiculous amounts of weaponry, this turns into a firefight with the...
That's a terrible idea. Yeah. Jesus Christ. That's an awful plan.
Yeah, no. That's why I'm not a leader.
I don't know. I don't know what else to really talk about for the tabletop game, other than the fact that they try and balance it, and it is a business, and that's kind of where you run into little issues of slight annoyance and salt on my part.
Yeah.
Of there's this particular faction, and they get released. They're pretty strong, so they release other models and units for other factions to try and catch up.
Yeah.
So everyone has to buy those models to try and keep up with the model or the faction that was just released.
Yeah.
And then you run into the issue of things just piggybacking and crawling up the scale. And then, but the thing is, the coolest part about War Machine is that the oldest models still are viable in the game. Like, they are still active pieces. You will see the oldest model on the table, guaranteed.
Because, how old is the game? Like,
I honestly couldn't tell you. I want to say 10 years, maybe. Okay. Maybe a little bit more. I'm not entirely
sure.
That's
kind of young for a tabletop game.
It is young. It's considerably younger than most games. And
it's younger than me. Wow.
I think because of that, because of it being as young as it is, it's seen other tabletop games like Warhammer 40K, which is just a big, complicated mess of rules that that as they publish new, faction books, change rules. Like, you have to go by the newest book and what rules that book says.
Sort of like the DSM.
And it's awful. It's a big bird's nest of trying to find what rule is actually applicable to the situation.
Yeah.
And I think that with Warhammer, or War Machine, it's a lot... They're just very similar names. But War Machine, it's a lot cleaner. They had Mark I, which they completely re-released. They cleaned up everything. I think that's something that a lot of games need to do.
Yeah.
Is have a Mark II. Warhammer needs to do a Mark II, for lack of a better term, that just cleans up everything and resets everything at a standard.
Yeah. I'm just at this picture of, like, a bunch of these guys just coming together, their pieces are on the table, and then they've got like these massive reference books, and the entire time is just spent just like searching through these reference books and screaming.
I would say that's kind of how Warhammer is.
That's amazing.
War Machine, however, is not. They're a lot simplistic, a lot more simplistic. Whereas Warhammer is a big open battlefield of lots of infantry units, armor running around, trying to take care of things. War Machine is more of a skirmish type deal, so it's smaller armies. However, me being the glutton for punishment I am, I want to do the Unbound, which is basically takes those skirmishes and just ups it quite a bit to where you have like gigantic battles, and they actually had to extend the size of the general table that you play on just to warrant it being able to be, you know, be viable. And I want to do it so bad, but I can't find anybody that wants to do it against me, because it'll take a day just to play one game, probably.
Yeah, that would be... I mean, that'd be cool. I guess, you know, it sounds like a lot of the pastimes for our generation are basically just, like, gigantic and complex feats that, I mean, don't require necessarily, like, a lot of pondering, but they require just a lot of, like, think grinding, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Which is interesting. Hey, that's... autism is on the rise. But, yeah, I guess... I don't know, it's... What... So tabletop gaming, I think we can agree, is cooler than model railroading.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean...
But... And even cooler to that NYU student we're talking about, right?
Right.
Perhaps it would be good to elaborate as to why it's cooler. Because there's an artistic element, which, I mean, there can be for model railroading, of course, but model railroading is replicating.
Yes.
There's a lot more replication, I feel like, by the youth in their pastimes, in the past, like models, models, really. Models in a lot of different forms.
Yeah.
Whereas now there's a lot of replicating. It's just new stuff.
Just new stuff.
Maybe not seen.
I guess
in reality.
I could talk about the hobbyist side of War Machine.
Because, well, I mean, you paint stuff.
I do paint.
The stuff that you have is really intricately painted, and it takes
a lot.
And
I'm not even that great of a hobbyist.
I don't want to meet a good one.
They're insane. They're insane. The craziest guy I know, I can't even for the life of me remember his name. I want to say it's Jay, but it doesn't matter. Takes a $60 a model that he has just spares of laying around.
Yeah.
Because he actually gets paid to paint. People pay him to paint their models and do a thing.
Wow.
Yeah. He takes a $60 model and is like, I'm not going to use it. Cuts it in half and then puts the top part onto a base, which is what all these models sit on.
Yeah.
They have different size bases depicting their girth or their girth.
Some that are literally just reference. Bodies.
Just to represent their size on the table.
Yeah.
And there's in order to take part in a hardcore tournament, you have to have your base like at the very least glue with dirt, which is what I do. I just put glue and I put dirt looking stuff on it, and I put my model on top of the dirt and it's good.
Nice.
it's high five, nailed it. I might even go so far as to put some snow on there because I do play the northern faction of Russia.
That's cool.
They're not actually Russians, but they basically are communist Russia.
Of course they are.
It's hilarious. I love them. They're my favorite. But so he takes a $60 model, cuts it in half, sticks the top part on a base, scars it up, makes it look all nasty and gnarled, you know, finishes the base, and then proceeds to take a troll and put it on top of that model.
Yeah.
Another $60 model. And he just is insane about this stuff. And he reposes them. He sculpts. He actually takes green stuff, which is modeling putty, and re-sculpts some of these parts so that he can position the model however he wants it to be positioned.
Yeah.
And he gets so in-depth with it, and you look at his stuff, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, he actually sits there and highlights things, and he spends hours on these things, whereas I'm like, splash on paint.
Yeah.
Splash, and I go through all of my models, and I just assembly line. I just paint all of the one color, and then I paint all of the next on the next layer, and then I just keep going that way, and it comes, and then at the very end, I do touch-ups where I, you know, my hand shook too much, and I painted something I didn't want.
Yeah.
And it turns out, you know, adequate. I will say that my painting is adequate.
Yeah.
But it's not great. And there's people that actually just, they don't even play the game. They just want to paint the models. And those people terrify me.
Yeah, see, we're talking about the same type of person that really is into hardcore model railroading, though. The people that just are, that like, anal attention to detail and you know, the people that model, like, all of Manhattan in the basement of a big building, and they mod it by putting tracks in the ceiling and suspending themselves from, like, a hammock sort of thing.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and wheeling over the town, you know, and replacing it. Yeah, yeah, that, I mean, that's the same type. I don't know. I guess for me, when I was a kid, so I was really into airplanes and tractors and cars, and but mostly model airplanes, I think, in terms of models, airplanes were the main thing. My dad would get me a model airplane, and I would sort of just get the base structure together, and I'd be like, good enough. You know, and the glue, I wouldn't give the glue the time to dry. Wouldn't paint them at all. It would just be, so they'd just be like the plastic, or the matte gray, yeah. And that was good enough. And they were horribly made, you know, like they were, and that's, yeah. I guess, I don't know, that's probably why I don't have that component of my brain that makes me want to do those things.
Yeah, no, but there are people that are like you, that just don't want to do the modeling. So they just, they put it together, kinda, and they just, you know, slap it all together, put it on a base. They just want to play the game. So they just buy these models and put it all together and then put it on the table. And to me, I'm just like, I can't even look at that stuff because I will not field a unit that is unpainted. I won't do it.
Yeah.
Because I like my stuff to look, you know, presentable.
Yeah. I have no pride, really, in the things that I do. And I have no competitive drive. So all of the components that would lead me into a tabletop gaming.
You do not have.
I don't have. So that's why.
I'm not a super hyper competitive person until I start playing that game.
Yeah.
Until those die rolls start going really badly, I'm hyper competitive. And then when they start just going straight to shit and I've lost half my army and they're still sitting at full capacity, I'm just like, and let's try some stupid tactics.
Yeah, that would
that's kind of how it goes for me, though. I mean, like, you got sometimes you can get really lucky, and that's how I've pulled off, like, 3 or 4 victories. I just got really lucky because I had a last-ditch effort of, well, let's see if it works, ? And, you know, throw my stuff at their caster, manage to kill their caster, which, I guess, chess reference, king, queen, it's your king and your queen, most powerful piece. If it dies, you lose.
Yeah.
Pretty sweet. If you manage to kill it, you win. And I was like, well, last-ditch effort, let's kill the caster. Did I do it? Nope. Okay, I'm dead this turn.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I hear a lot of hate from people who, I don't know, don't have much exposure to nerd culture on tabletop gaming. Even, actually, I hear a lot of hate in the MMO community, which is sort of pseudo-nerd. But for those of you out there that are laughing at tabletop gamers, remember, model railroaders exist, and,
I don't want to say they're far worse, but...
In 2014, yeah, they're worse. I've always thought that model railroading was interesting. I love, like, there's an entire genre of people on YouTube that train spot. And it's not just, like, a few videos. It's, like, thousands of videos of people, like, will go out there and then, like, they get up at 6 a.m. to go watch this old, dinky trait train go by in India, you know, and...
Hang on, did you say trait fane?
Freight train. It's freight... trait fane. The interesting thing is that those are both words. Fane traits.
Anyway,
look at this wordplay. Look at what I'm
sorry to interrupt. Carry on.
Master of the English language.
Carry on, my wayward son. That'll be peace when you're done.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I had it, but there's an entire community of people that just really love trains, and I'm just like, I like trains a lot, but I like steam locomotives, and those are what really interests me.
But it's in the mechanics behind it, not necessarily the train, right?
Well, I mean, the whole vintage, the retro-ness is cool. I mean, it's not, I don't get off to that. I don't know, like, steam locomotives are to me one of the more fascinating. Anything powered by steam is really pretty fascinating. But steam tractors. Hey, those of you, hey kids out there. Hey you, millennial college students, go to your local Thrashers reunion. You will have a blast. That's actually not totally weird. It'd be interesting, I think, but maybe not to anyone else but me. Or like a small engine convention was the best. But anyway, so they're like living of mechanical transportation. I think most transportation is mechanical. So of transportation, steam locomotives are, they just really feel alive because, if you talk to someone who engineers of steam locomotives, like they have moods, they'll just randomly, I mean, cause they're just gigantic instruments basically that require constant care and attention and tuning and they're so, you know, huge and complex, and they're dealing with such huge force and such elemental force that they seem alive. I think that's one of, whereas diesel locomotives, I mean, literally are just diesel engines on generators with electric motors in the wheels, and I don't get the interest. I don't get how, like, because once you get into the diesel era, everything is uninteresting to me. But so trains. Yeah, well, train spotting, that's a movie about punks. Punks are cool. Okay. Important thing. So, only recently have I been able to watch movies and not, like, watch movies for something other than, like, look at that cool thing that's in there. You know what I'm saying? Like, it'd be like, well, wow, there's a Hawker Hurricane in this movie. I'm gonna watch that entire movie to see that plane. Battle of Britain was... it's a good movie, because there's a lot of old British planes. But anyway, so only recently have I developed an understanding of quote, the human condition. I still make fun of it all the time, because it's funny. But this ability to understand it has made movies that, like, most movies are interesting to me now. So I watched Breakfast at Tiffany's the other night, because I assumed that I was gonna... that it would put me to sleep. And I stayed engaged for at least 3/4 of the movie before I had to take a break. And I don't know, have you ever seen that movie?
No, I have not.
That's disappointing. But
you want me to watch that movie?
No.
Oh.
I mean, it's not like nothing really cool happens in it. It's the funniest thing about that movie to me is being in 2014, being exposed to the culture I have been, all I could think of, like, through that movie is, like, what a massive shit on the proletariat it is. It's basically, like, this white girl growing up in a hick town runs away because the town's not cool, goes to a city, lives off of everybody, spends her entire life having sex with rich men and going to parties, and that's, like, romanticized in that movie, which I think is great, right? Because, like, it's not even, like, romanticized as... wow, that's cool, but an unsustainable lifestyle. It kind of is, because at the end, it's basically, like, the very, very end of the movie, the climax, she eventually turns around and becomes, or at least is assumed that she becomes, she enters a relatively normal relationship with someone. But, up until that point, it's pretty much romanticism. I don't know, I can't decide if the movie's a critique of that character or glorifying it, because I didn't grow up in the 60s. But anyway, basically, like, all I can think about that entire movie is, like, it's just a bunch of, like, white people, like, scheming themselves into living these really luxurious lifestyles. It's amazing. But Audrey Hepburn is, like, the most boring celebrity ever, because she plays that character in the movie, but then in real life she's, like, a humanitarian, and that's just boring. That's boring. Humanitarianism is boring. It's I mean, maybe it wasn't in when it wasn't as glorified as it is, but you, like, literally cannot be a celebrity and not be
a humanitarian.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I've seen that. I've noticed that. Yeah. But it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just, it feels like they're forcing it.
Well, I think Audrey was one of the people, she's dead, was one of the people that legitimately, I mean, she was the fucking ambassador to UNICEF.
Right.
You know, so.
But now you see all these commercials of, with celebrities in it, like, the celebrities are going to pull people into helping whatever cause it is that the celebrity's broadcasting, and they just have, it's the same format every single time, where it starts out with the celebrity, one celebrity just kind of hosting it, for lack of a better term, hosting the commercial, explaining what it's about, and then a bunch of other celebrities all saying one word of an ending sentence.
Yeah. Like, I am now known as a humanitarian because I said the word end on a commercial.
Right. And it's just, like, all they're doing is putting their faces out there, hoping that they'll pull people into it. And it probably works. It just doesn't work on me or a lot of other people that just, outside of an actor's actual career, I don't give a fuck. I don't care about their personal lives.
No, it shouldn't matter, really.
It doesn't matter to me. When someone tells me, oh, did you hear this person did such and such? Who is this person? They played in this movie. Oh, okay. I know who that actor is as that character.
Yeah.
And that's all that actor is to me, is that character in that movie. And I can critique them as an actor and how well they did in that movie. I don't care what they did in their personal life.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of that is people confusing actors with their characters. I mean, I do that. Like, as much as I would like Gillian Anderson, this is not going to make any sense to you because you don't watch The X-Files, but as much as I would like Gillian Anderson to be like Agent Scully, the infinite skeptic scientist, jujitsu doctor, priest, that is not an accurate description of Dana Scully. But, hey, that might make you want to go watch The X-Files. Why am I advertising for The X-Files?
I might watch The X-Files because of this.
But anyway. So,
soulless ad bot.
As interesting as that would be if Gillian Anderson was like Agent Scully, and as my mind just kind of assumes, right? That's how identity works with humans is, you know, it's like something we can't get past. So I'm always going to identify Gillian Anderson as Agent Scully. So when she laughs, it's like, what the fuck, you know, which, because Agent Scully doesn't laugh. But anyway, she does. She's just very, I'm not going to get into that character. Anyway. But, you know, or how, like, John Hamm and Don Draper have nothing in common. John Hamm being a more or less simpleton guy that likes hockey. That's all John Hamm is he's like, I'm a Blues fan. He doesn't actually have that accent. That was an illegitimate accent. Okay. But, that's a common thing, and which is why people care about personal lives. I mean, I research celebrities all the time that play characters in the characters that I like, because it's like a natural fascination. Like, what do they think of the character? Is there some bit of them in this character? But I have a, like, not obsession, but a preference for characters that, either are really analytical or really cold or actual psychopaths or lack empathy or all that stuff. Those characters really interest me a lot, so that's...
And being able to play a character like that kind of requires... I feel like... I don't know if you've ever watched the show Hannibal.
Oh, it sounds really... I probably did when I was, like, 8, but...
Not the movie. No, it's a show. It's a TV show. It's relatively new.
No, I oh, never mind. Then no.
It's... There's Hannibal the movie, I'm pretty sure.
I don't know.
But then there's a movie, or a TV show that's called Hannibal, and it's basically... The main character is criminal... is an analytical type character, but he has he actually has absolute empathy, which allows him to step into the criminal's mindset, and unfortunately that affects him.
Yeah.
And he actually drags him into being mentally unstable.
Yeah.
And I think that being able to play someone that you watch them in the like, he's a great actor for being able to pull this off. Being able to start out relatively stable-minded but having this empathy issue, and then completely losing his mind by the end of the show, and being able to do that and perform that, I think it requires you to have a little bit of psychopathic tendencies that the character has. Like, that's just a hard thing to act, purely act, and do well with.
Kind of depends on what school you're coming from, which is almost impossible to tell. Well, at least not for... I mean, I'm not an expert in acting by any means, but I actually think that it depends on how much you believe your situation. So, you know, the reason why actors can cry on cue is because they can actually, they are living the situation that their characters are in,
mm-hmm.
Which evokes an emotional response. I mean, I don't know, being a good actor really just, to me, means a really good understanding of your character, being in touch with your characters. But I don't know, like, for one thing, I could talk about this for weeks, but the common perception of people without empathy is actually very skewed and weird, and I have yet to see, like, an actual sociopath or psychopath as they exist in real life, or at least most of them, in a film. So, which is why I'm making a film with a real psychopath in it. But he's also crazy. He's just fucking insane. But, but anyway, yeah. Oh, we're talking about characters. That's a great segue. Oh, man. I never used the word segue
way
until tonight. And I'll probably just edit it out.
I would rather you... I appreciate you editing it out.
That's a great... Yeah, that's it. That'll be it. So we're going to talk about...
This is
going to
be the most difficult topic, I think, tonight. For me, personally. Just...
Writing? Yeah, we're going to talk about writing books, being an author, accepting the title author. We're both authors.
We are both authors.
Yeah.
Just in different aspects, kind of. I mean, I don't know. You write books, too.
Yeah.
So you just do you're broader than I am. I just want to write short stories and novels, and that's all I want to do. I'm not really into the whole filmography thing. I would like to be able to do it, but I just don't have the mindset for it.
Honestly, I don't know if you've ever tried writing in screenplay format.
I haven't, and I thought about it when you explained it how it would kind of work for me. I think it might work, but definitely not as like you said, you want to edit it 4,000 times. I think it would definitely be like one of the first forms of my writing. It would start out as screenplay form, and then I would kind of...
Yeah, no, I have, like, Children of the Corn 30 was the first time that I had sat down and written in the format, and I learned the format. I've since forgotten it, because I haven't worked on that screenplay in way too long. But I actually, what I have right now is a pretty clean script, but I really like it because what it does is it confronts all of my weaknesses, which my problem is that I have very little discipline, and not just in the, you know, I don't have any self-discipline way, but, like, the actual, like, because I'm so all over the place, it's very difficult to sit down and get one story together, which, what I do, I mean, my approach to writing stories is very much character driven. Like, I get my characters and I develop who they are first before, I mean, I have a general idea of the plot, but, and then I insert them into this, the problem. So I develop a problem and I insert these characters that I've, literally lived with. One of my exercises is to, so for like a week or for a month, you live with your character. When you wake up, you're thinking, what is my character thinking right now? What would my character think in this situation? And, which I think is a relatively original to me.
I can see that as being a way of doing things. And it's my way is not entirely unlike yours. My way is, I'm also an artist.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where my stories start, is I draw my character. And if you look at my characters, you see that there's little detail. I'm a very detail-oriented person when I'm drawing. So there's little things in there that I know exactly why that thing is the way it is.
Yeah.
And there's a story behind every little detail that I put in my character. And that, all of that is in my head. Like, it's visual. I don't know. I have a fairly good memory for things like that. Like, yeah. I know that I did this for a very specific reason because it, and the story just pops up in my head and I have it. And I know exactly why this character is where he is. And that's almost identical to what you do, just in a smaller time frame.
It's also very, I mean, I envy you in that, because one of my big weaknesses in story development is that I can't visualize my characters. And it's really frustrating.
That has got to be,
especially for a character that you really love, like, you want to be able to see their face, but I can't, really. So, yeah, that's a big problem. But I have below average, ability to visualize and draw things. The only people I can draw are, like, stick figures.
For a while, I was doing a little comic strip where it was just stick characters, and the only defining trait between the characters was an article of clothing that only that stick character had, or in their weapon. And that was where I started doing my storyboarding, because I realized when I did that, I was like, oh, well, that makes it a lot easier for me to focus on getting the story out, and then I can just add on to the stick figures and actually add detail. Yeah. And so when I did my first comic, my actual very first comic that will never see the light of day, because it's awful.
Rare.
I was 12.
Underground.
But when I first started, I kind of knew where I wanted to go with the boxes, the format of it, and I just drew stick figures.
Yeah.
And I drew the one defining trait of that character. And I wrote out the story, and that way I wasn't so caught up on trying to finish that one frame that I forgot where I was going with the story.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's storyboarding.
I've heard
is an amazing tool.
It is an amazing tool, and I'm very recently trying to develop that a lot more.
Yeah.
I didn't show you any of my stuff because you told me not to, and I didn't, which is why this is a very particularly difficult subject for me to talk about without expanding onto my own ideas.
Well, I didn't mean, I just, it was more of a suggestion, but...
Yeah. No, it's definitely a good idea, and especially if this is going to be on the interwebs. If my brain baby gets stolen, I would be ruined for life.
Well, we were talking about, you know, the David Blue copyright.
Is
more or less a hit order on somebody.
If you take David Blue's stuff, he will find you, and he will kill you.
Yeah, but I mean, that'd be only if I actually had stuff that, if that's taking money away from me, then yeah, but that is very far in the future.
Right.
I mean, so...
Well, I mean, my ideas are just... I've been working on my novel since I was 13.
That's amazing.
I mean, it's been an evolving... Like, I have watched this thing grow up.
Yeah.
Because it started out very childish. It started out as, oh, man, I want to make a vampire novel. And then Twilight happened. And then all the other vampire and supernatural teen fiction happened. And I was like, nope. Yeah. And I just, all I did was take the characters.
Capitalize on that?
No.
This is like...
I'm not a loser. I may not be cool, but I'm not a loser.
Yeah.
But so all I did was I took my characters that I poured my heart into creating.
Yeah.
I took those characters and I had to remake them, and it hurt a little bit, but I think they became more mature because of it. Because I was, at that stage of my life, relying on things that I'd already read, things that I had seen, things that, instead of using my own ideas, I was kind of taking their ideas and then tweaking a little bit and being like, oh, that's my idea, I made that up, it's mine.
Yeah.
That's me, that's all me.
So I have the exact opposite problem in that when I write, it takes effort for it to not be completely just a spew of ideology that is interpreted as insanity and is almost, it's not readable.
It's like, it's not readable.
I mean, it's not readable by anyone unless you're, like, fucking insane, so.
I've let my girlfriend read my storyboard, and she tells me it's unreadable.
Oh, wow.
But not in, it's more unreadable in the fact that when I get into the momentum of things, I write very quickly and my...
So it's actually physically illegible.
It's physically illegible.
Okay.
Because, like, I can't, I... my letters start to... I write like I'm drunk, basically. Yeah. I think that's the best way for me to describe it, is I write drunk. And you watch, when I'm starting, I build up momentum quick. I start and everything's neat and organized.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you've seen my handwriting, but I write very tiny, very neat.
Yeah.
And towards the end, it's huge and illegible, and it's just it's basically symbols at that point. It's symbols.
The medium becomes inadequate. No, I get that. That's why, like, I bought a typewriter. All right, I bought a typewriter a long time ago. Not particularly with the intention of using it, but...
Well, fun to type on. Not exactly.
Well, when you realize that, I mean, like, all the authors, you know, most of the authors that you've read typed their manuscripts up on a fucking typewriter, mm-hmm. and I'd be fucking screwed. I mean, I make so many mistakes in my typing. However, I also type not ridiculously quickly, not academically record-breaking quickly, but I type almost fast enough to be able to keep up with the thought.
Oh god, I can't type as fast as I think. I can write as fast as I think. I just cannot type as fast as I think.
See, I'm the opposite. So writing is not fast enough for me, and I often lose my train of thought in writing, which is why, or physically writing. But I think that's actually, I was exposed to some academic literature that suggested, I know that's probably not a new thing, but the like how valuable handwriting is in your thought process as a writer. So I've been trying to write more things by hand. Write like lists, to-do lists. I've always done that, but actually writing stories by hand is an entirely new challenge. So
where I think that you'll find it more enjoyable is if you can manage to keep up. If you can keep up with your writing, with your thought process, you're gonna find that the whole editing thing, because I write my initial draft on paper and then I transfer it onto a computer.
Yeah,
and that's when you find all sorts of little things that you can just be like, oh, I can add this in here. I can add this in here.
Oh, well, I mean, I do that.
Add this in here. And you're going to do that normally.
Yeah.
But the cool thing about it is, instead of like having, I don't know how, if you have dual monitors or how you, you know, transfer data from, but when you have a piece of paper sitting there, you can, you know, type and write as you're, you know, writing, and then you can make more little notes, and you're like, oh, well, I need to expand on this in the future, like on a different chapter or in a different story arc. And I think that is extremely helpful, because you'll have a hard copy of your notes of, so like, if you don't have a computer available to you, you're going to be like, oh, that's right, I need to talk about this now. I need to make sure that I expand on this and make sure that this is well understood, because at least in my novel, I'm creating entire universes.
Yeah.
And it's hard.
Oh yeah, I can imagine.
It is not easy. I'm actually reaching out, kind of micromanaging. I reached out to you. I don't have a vast knowledge of military branches despite my military background.
Yeah.
Or military ranking, despite my military background. So I reach out to you. Hey, do you want to help me make, my military ranking in one of my universes?
Yeah.
To which you replied with, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, I have to reach out, and I have to kind of pull resources like that, because I don't have vast knowledge on everything, obviously, that would build a society.
Means is military consultant.
Yeah. It's just, but I mean, and it's not even that big of a detail to me. Like, it doesn't play that much of a role in the novel, but I'm going down so deep into creating this entire universe because I need to know how the entire universe is going to react to what my character does.
Yeah.
And my character is going to end up having that much of a snowball effect in his world that it's bone-shattering. It's insane.
Yeah.
And I like the whole rags-to-riches. That's something I really wanted to get through, and I decided, or I came to the conclusion, that I can't do that with one of my main character. For the record, I have 27...
Jesus Christ.
30 main characters?
I don't want that.
Right? But, like, I'm an idiot. I'm dumb, because every author I've ever known writes a few, like, trilogies, maybe just a single book, a couple trilogies, and then maybe writes their epic.
Yeah.
Maybe. If they feel up to it. I'm jumping right into epic. Like, that is what I'm doing from the get-go. And I don't know that that's a good plan. I'm gonna kill myself doing this.
Yeah.
I just...
Well, since you're not depending on, you know, your food doesn't come from writing.
Right.
Authors, I've never really got... I guess I probably envy the ability for an author to say, I think it's time for me to write a mystery. And then they just, you know, just shit out a mystery. That's not how I work. Like, I develop an idea, an idea for a story comes to me, and I make it in... I mean, I don't even understand genre. One of the things that I have to do for the project that I've recently started on, I guess I've restarted... Actually, I could just say the project that I worked on for a long time is one of the things that I intend to investigate more is genre and studying genre. Not because I necessarily want to fit it in a genre, but I guess kind of. I don't know. I kind of want to be able to put a genre on something that I've written, because the only major work of fiction that I've really written completely that's available and coming soon for all of AWS is Children of the Corn, Children of the Corn 30. And what is Children of the Corn 30? For one thing, it's the story concept is not all mine, but the original aspects that I contributed, it's literally an Amish exploitation movie. And where does that fall in? You know, where would that fall in even in a book? Right. So, but something that I was thinking about as you were talking is an issue that I guess I don't hear talked about by a lot of authors, not that I listen to many, is how much knowledge you have on the intellectual property that you're writing in, that you've created, and how much of that knowledge will be dispensed. And I found that in order to create a story, and nothing, I don't write things that are departed. I mean, science fiction would be like the most, that'd be the best way to describe the biggest departure from reality that I could make, right? They're all going to be in this world or one similar to it, because the setting is not just, it's just not an important part. And it's never going to be, because I don't have that big visual, I can't create big landscapes. So I'm glad that there are people out there, I'm glad that there are people like you out there to do that, because it makes things interesting. But anyway, what was I saying? I was talking about... I've almost lost my trail of thought, but I actually did there. I was talking about... And the knowledge that you retain. Okay.
Yeah.
But more or less, I found that it's best or most advantageous to have absolute knowledge, more or less, of your intellectual property before you begin writing within it.
I agree with you 100%.
And
100%.
But the problem with that is, I mean, you're going to get discouraged, you know, sitting down, deciding these little bits that may or may not be relevant to your story at all, but you do it anyway because that way you have them there and you don't have to. And then you sit down and you have to build up all this stuff before you actually get into writing the plot, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's discouraging sometimes. I mean, you look at what you've done to what you in your head, in your to-do list, what you have left to do, and you're just like, how do I create an entire society?
Yeah.
How do I create multiple societies within a single world? Yeah. How do I expand on that and then create multiple worlds with multiple societies? And it's mind-boggling, and that's where I came up with a little trick, but I'll let you continue.
Well, I'm not sure if I have
anything else to say. Okay, so I came up with a little trick. I kind of took it from playing... I actually learned it through playing D&D, where they have random... shit generators. Random shit generators. I know what's supposed
to be. Are you about to tell me that you're going to randomly generate your book? Because I've already done that.
Kind of. What I do is I write out I use a D20. I'm actually using dice to do this.
That's awesome.
I use a D20, and so I have. I'm going to touch on. My novel contains three. It's a multiverse. But there's three main aspects that each world has a varying level of. And so on a D20, I have a list of what each aspect is, or how the varying degree of it. And then I have another list of what kind of society it has, another list of what kind of government runs it, another list, and just lists and lists and lists and lists. And I actually have an entire Google document with 400 worlds randomly generated.
Damn.
But it's all very vague. I mean, it's detailed, but it's vague. It's like, there's no names, there's no actual places or things like that. It's the bare bones of what a society is. And then when I get to needing that world, I just randomly pull one out.
Yeah,
that fits the criteria of what I need for this world. And then I start fleshing it out, and I start adding the muscle, adding the veins, adding everything to it. And then eventually I get this astounding piece of work, and I'm just like, hey, good job, Terry, high five. And then I completely delete that world. That world's gone.
Yeah.
Because I obviously don't want to be like randomly pull out another world.
Yeah.
Oops.
Yeah. I said this to you before. I mean, you really are Gene Roddenberry 2.
Gene Roddenberry 2. For our viewers, who is Gene Roddenberry?
Well, I hope they would know. I guess no. I have assumed that Gene Roddenberry is more famous than he actually is.
He is definitely not as famous as you think he is.
Yes. I guess I've been a Star Trek nerd for a long time, but Gene Roddenberry conceptualized Star Trek, but he didn't develop to the extent that, you know, he didn't develop all the societies. He developed quite a few, Gene Roddenberry created it, but obviously a lot of what is considered canon, in fact, probably most of it, was created by other people. But, you know, with Gene Roddenberry, that, like, it's really not that hard to... I guess I shouldn't say that. It's kind of insulting. But it's not that hard to create a race in Star Trek and in Star Trek canon. They're none of them are really, you know, they're not that extreme. At least from my perspective.
I can agree with you on that. Yeah. I don't want to downgrade what he's done. He's definitely accomplished some amazing things, but
yeah. Well, I mean, Gene Roddenberry, like he never intended. I don't want to go into explaining the entire history of Star Trek, but
right.
Gene Roddenberry actually didn't intend to create a world. He intended to communicate a message. And he did that part, and sort of everyone else took that and expanded it into
right.
And the message is still there, definitely. Even though, well, yeah, I don't want to get into that. That's like, but it's the message is kind of contradictory and a little bit naive and a little bit ignorant, and that comes out in Star Trek Online, for instance. So in the future, in Gene Roddenberry's future, there's no currency, right? In Star Trek Online, you know, how many currencies are there? And there's no way that you could possibly organize a society, even in that set, without currency. It works in the show, but it, you know, when you actually apply it in a game. But then again, I mean, it's a game for a capitalist audience, so, you know, my critique probably falls short there, and I don't have the energy to continue it. So.
Right. The other thing is, speaking of creating races, is I run into issue with recycling well-known races. Dwarves, elves, orcs. Everything is just recycle upon recycle
yeah.
upon recycle upon. And they'll tweak it. They'll try and make it their own.
I don't know why you would. It just makes it annoying.
But, yeah, that's what I was about to say. It makes it annoying. Because you call them a dwarf.
Yeah.
Or, better example, you call them a vampire. But these vampires can go out in the daylight. These vampires not only can go out in the daylight, but they sparkle in the daylight. I hate Twilight so much.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
I'm going to try and stay away from my salty subjects, but I can't stand authors. It feels lazy to me. I don't want to call authors lazy because there's amazing authors that do wonderful things with these mythological races, but it just feels lazy, and I don't really know where I'm going with this, but I want people to put more effort into their writing that. These new things that get published, I just want more effort out of it. I want more more in depth. I want invoke thought. For the love of God, invoke a thought. And
yeah. I think if you probably don't want my opinion on that, but I think the problem with a lot of books in the mainstream, really for most of the history of literature, is that from my perspective, most of the stories, like 95% of the stories that I read, say the exact same thing in a theme. The theme is like come from the exact same thing. And so I don't think it's there are very few books that I've read, modern fiction, that really invoke thought. And I think, I mean, I know, like, my book, for instance, is really... I guess I shouldn't talk about it. I'm not supposed to talk about it.
Hmm.
But it's more ideology-spewing than anything. What I've done is I've taken an idea and given a set of characters to explore that idea and a plot to explore that idea. And that I can tell you right now, is the only type of fiction I'll ever be able to write. It's just the way my mind works. I'll never be able to create worlds or races. Or, I probably could, but they would just be ideas manifested in, you know,
right.
It really wouldn't be like a fictional excursion. Do you want to go? When do you want to go?
Now.
Okay. let me see if I can... I feel like there was one more thing that I wanted to talk about to wrap up. We've gone through the news. No?
Not really. I'm pretty sure we touched everything.
We've got... Oh. All right. So, with that concluded, we've talked a lot about author stuff. Terry and I will be hosting the National Edgy Awards.
Oh, right.
for 2016. So that you guys can be excited for that. But...
In 2016.
Yeah. Okay. Well... This has been episode 3 of Drycast. Thank you, Terry, for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I hope we see you in the future. For those of us joining us in TeamSpeak, which would be no one, y'all, fuck you guys. anyone listening to the live stream, hello, goodbye. Remember, visit drywall.ws. You can find everything about us there. If you're more interested in the podcast, drywall.ws/drycast, or you can search Drycast in iTunes. This has been Drycast Episode 3. Good morning.
God damn it.
Damn. Wow.
That was a lot more than I was expecting. And I didn't even cover half the things I wanted to talk about when it comes to writing.
Yeah, well, that's good, because that means you have an incentive to come back. All right, just want to make sure it's intact. Let's see. All right, we can... Oh, yeah, I don't have to drive you home.
No.
Dude, that's fucking weird. That never happens.
All right, but I have to kind of... Ow! Oh, my God, my neck hurts. So, you need to...
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I just need to... Oh,
where are you? Interesting.
Here, you can keep these here, but I do need the splitter.
Yep.
For when I do my...
I'm gonna have to score me one of these.
How expensive.
All right. There we go.
Just hang on the headphones that way, they're here.
I guess I should end the stream. Maybe. Goodbye, you little shits.